This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Radio Scotland.
Today we've got something slightly different for you. As you probably know, myself and my colleague Ewan McElraith present a radio programme called Out of Doors, and we look at stuff that happens outside in Scotland, hence the Scotland Outdoors podcast. But I also do a social history series called Our Story. And it crossed my mind that you might find this interesting. Yesterday, the Scottish Football Association, the SFA, capped several players who'd taken part in a home international between England and Scotland. Now, nothing terribly unusual about that, except this match happened in 1972, and the players were all women. It dates back to a time when not only was women's football in Scotland not recognised, the authorities were doing absolutely everything in their power to try and stop it happening in the first place. I know nothing about football. What I know about football, you could write in the back of a postage stamp. And I found this absolutely fascinating. The women were inspiring. Their passion, their determination, their sheer guts. I hope, I'm sure, you'll enjoy meeting them.
Football was a man's game. The women should be in the kitchen at the sink. It's the attitude of most men that I've met.
We were getting looked down on in Scotland, but I wasn't caring because I was on a mission. I was going to be a footballer and I could do what the hell I wanted. Here come the
girl. In 1921, football for women was banned until 1974. And it meant the women weren't allowed to use the football pitches, they weren't allowed to use referees or anything. We were looked upon as being abnormal. In the 60s, we had nothing. The ball was borrowed for the guys' team, the strips were borrowed, we stuck Sunday posts down, our socks were shin guards, we had fishing nets for goal nets, and that was us ready to go.
When they said I was the best female footballer in the world, I just thought to myself, that's not bad for a wee lassie for shooting.
Rose was a Ronaldo, better than a Ronaldo, but the obstacles she came up against were unimaginable, all because we're banned from playing football, the game that we loved.
It's one of the greatest stories in Scottish football. A battle against the odds and against football's own governing body. The men in suits that really, really didn't want them to play. I'm Mark Stephen. This is BBC Radio Scotland. And this week, our story belongs to Scotland's pioneering women footballers. Elsie Cook started as a player, but ended up as manager of Scotland's international women's side. She began a love affair with a beautiful game in 1961, after her mum, who was a netball coach, was asked to form a ladies' football side to play a game for charity. At least the team name, Stuart and Thistle Ladies FC, sounded impressive.
We hadn't a clue how to play the game, and we heard of this girl, Susan Ferris, from Kilmarnock, and the boys all said, oh, you need to get Susie playing for you, she runs rings around all the boys, great header of the ball, fantastic shot, you must get Susan. And by God, she was incredible. I can still hear my mother shouting to me, give the ball to Susie! She scored the 7 goals. We won 7-1, and she was an inspiration. And that encouraged me to participate in women's football. I'd never heard of women's football up until this moment. It was such a fantastic game.
Now, you may never have heard of Rose Riley. To be honest, I hadn't. But we should have done. Rose has the unique distinction of being the only Scottish player, male or female, to be part of a World Cup winning side. To be frank, she seems to have been born to it.
When I was a wee girl, I was 3 years of age, and I went missing one day. My mother found me at the football park. Then, when I was about 4 or 5, I got a doll for Christmas, as you do, and I was devastated because I wanted a football, but I went out and swapped it for a ball. And I used to sleep with the ball every night. First, because I was in love with the ball, and second, I was afraid somebody would steal it. So I guess I was just always going to be a footballer.
How old were you when you actually approached a side and said, "Give us a game"?
I was maybe about 6 or 7 years old. The manager of the local boys' team asked me if I would play with them because I was always playing at the park with the boys. There were no girls playing in the days. And I said, oh, God, that was great. He said, but you'll need to get changed at home. because the boys are in the clubhouse and you can't get in there and get changed with them. And you'll need to change your name to Ross because you will not be allowed to play because you're a wee girl. And you'll need to get a short back and sides. So I flew down to the local barber's, got a short back and sides, and my mother nearly killed me. But got my Fitbit strip and went to play. And in one particular game, I'd scored about 8 goals that day, running riot. And there was a Celtic scout at the match. And they asked my manager if we would like to sign the wee number 7. And he says, no, you can't, it's a wee lassie. And the scout said, no, the one that scored all the goals. So he shouts, Ross, come over here. And he said, I would like to sign you for Celtic. So I thought I'd died and went to heaven. Then realised I was a wee girl and that was it, my dream was over. So I was absolutely devastated because I thought at that early age, if I was good enough, why couldn't I go? We're Catholics, so we had to go to a Catholic school in the days. At lunchtime, discovered the boys were playing at football. So I just went there and played. It was better than a lot of them put together kind of thing. But when I come back in at first lunchtime, you get the corporal punishment. It was like the belt on your hands because I wasn't allowed in the playground. And I was told in no uncertain terms that I was banned from going to the boys' playground. But every day I went, I played the game and I got the belt after every game.
How did your mum and dad actually feel about you playing football?
They didn't agree with me playing football. Nobody did. It was a hard battle for me. Everybody thought I was strange. And my mother was quite a powerful woman. And my brothers and sisters, no. It was just kind of outlawed.
Did they try stopping you from doing it?
Later on, when I gave up my athletics career, I was in the shortlist for the Commonwealth Games and I had to go on a week's training camp to St Andrews. And the coach at the time said to me, you'll need to stop playing football because you're getting too much muscle in your thighs, like football legs, and it's not good for athletics. So while I had this future in athletics, I had no future in football. I'd actually stopped playing at football for 1 week for the first time since I was 3 years old, and I was devastated. So I got up after 5 days, gave up the athletic career, and just stuck to football where I had no future. So everybody just thought that I was crazy. But no, I knew in my heart football was my passion, it was my life.
Elsie and Rose first met in their hometown of Stewarton. On the face of it, it wasn't the best of starts.
That first game, 1961, we're standing blethering about the game outside the clubhouse and this wee boy came up to me and I just looked him up and down and he looked up at me with these big innocent green eyes. Oh, missus, can I get a game? And I looked back down at him. I says, son, it's a girls' team, it's a lassies' team. I says, you can't get a game for a lassies' team. And this wee impudent face looked up at me again and went, but I'm a lassie. And I went, oh my goodness, right, well, come back in 2 years' time then and we'll see what we can do. I didn't want to flatten her completely. She was tiny and her face was just shining because she was talking about football. That wee girl of 7 years old dictated the way my life was going to go.
How? Explain that.
Because 2 years later, Rose turned up when she was 9 and we were playing against Red Rockets from Johnston. And this wee 9-year-old, Rose Riley, had a place in our team that day on the right wing. And she was just fantastic. And she was the player that was to take the mantle from Susan Ferris, who was the first inspiration. And between Rose and Susan, I just became totally absorbed in women's football. There's never been anybody like Rose, and there never will be another Rose Riley. She had strength, she had ball control, a cracking shot, intricate footwork. She was a full package.
So here's Rose, this incredibly talented footballer, an athlete, hard-working and utterly dedicated. But Scotland was offering her nothing, so she decided to head abroad.
I was determined I was going to be a professional footballer. There was a team in France, Stade de Reims. So me and Edna, as soon as we were on the pitch, we ran riot and I think we had to sign at half-time for the Reims team.
They were that
impressed. Yeah. We go to Glasgow Airport and I think it was a hut at the time. There was no facilities and my suitcase burst open because it was just a cardboard one. So my dad got his braces off and his belt and fixed my suitcase. And I thought, nowadays I think, here's Rose going to Paris with a Louis Vuitton suitcase. Watch out, French people, here I come. But that didn't even upset me. I wasn't caring. I was just in a high going there. But then AC Milan had bought us and that's why we ended up in Italy.
Tell me about going to Italy. How different was it to competing in Scotland?
As soon as I come off the plane, I felt at home. For some unknown reason, I had no connection with Italy. I hadn't even ate spaghetti hoops, nothing. It was like a mother's embrace. There was a connection there. Started playing for AC Milan. We played in the San Siro, some of our games. Completely different culture. Obviously, the language barrier was immense. I stayed in a hotel on my own for about a year, and I used to speak in the mirror to myself at night so that somebody else was talking back to me, and it was myself. It was very lonely. Then I decided to buy a dictionary, and there was La Gazzetta dello Sport. That was another pink football paper, but it was out every day. So I bought that because that's what I was interested in, and I decided I was going to learn three words a day because I thought, I'm not academic. Four words is going to bamboozle me, and that's what I did. And then I just spoke with the locals. I had to walk about a mile to go to the local restaurant. I'd never been in a restaurant in my life. And here I was getting steaks and getting looked after by the Italians.
You were really valued in Italy.
Yes, I was so very proud to play for them. But it was always a Scottish heart beating under an Italian jersey.
How did you manage to play for the Italian national side? You haven't got an ounce of Italian blood in you.
I know. The Italians are lovable rogues. If they want something, they get it. In the days when I got picked to play for the Italian national team, there was about 40 other foreigners playing in this area at the time. It was very professional. And the Presidente Trabucco asked me if I would play for the Italian team. He said, you've been playing here for 5 years, Rose. I think you qualify. I said, so does the other 40 other ones. He says, no, you qualify. I said, right, OK. Scotland didn't want me. So I was so honoured to play for Italy.
What was it like coming back for the first time back to Scotland?
For the wee girl for Stuart that had left, just wear tracky trousers on or jeans or whatever, I'd found out the fashion in Milan. So I'd went and bought a trench coat that was beige Burberry and flared trousers and kind of wee boots with heels on, a handbag, never had a handbag in my life, nice haircut, I'd put a wee bit of makeup on. So it went through the door and my mother couldn't believe it. I don't even think she recognised me. And just before I got home, I was going up the hill where I used to keep you up the ball going for the newspaper. And it was very emotional because the wee girl had left Stuart and was coming back as a woman.
The ban imposed by the Scottish Football Association meant that in the 1960s, if you were a female who played football, you had to take the rules and, well, bend them like Beckham. Elsie Cook.
In a Sunday in the old days in the 60s, you went to Bible class, you went to church. Women didn't make a meal on a Sunday, they didn't hang a washing on a Sunday. All these things were taboo. And on a Sunday, the pitches were lying empty, so we could use the pitches. The SFA didn't allow us to use their pitches. The council didn't allow us to use their pitches because we weren't a registered team and they wouldn't register a girls' team. Everybody was against us. So I'd got up on a Sunday morning, get a bag of sawdust for the joiner, go and line the important bits, 18-yard books in the penalty spot, sweep the puddles. It was a grass pitch, and the puddles in the Goldmouth were really bad. Everything was borrowed. The ball was borrowed for the guys' team. The strips were borrowed. We stuck Sunday posts in, our socks were shin guards. We had fishing nets for goal nets, put up the fishing nets, and that was us ready to go. But we had no changing facilities, we had no referee or linesman. We were lucky if we could find an opponent to play in these days. There was only about four or five teams in the 60s, but the same teams were like ourselves. They were so passionate about their game, and we had some fantastic games with them. But trying to get a referee, it was usually the guy that came in the opposing side that refereed the game, which could cause problems.
Where did you get changed then if there was no pavilion?
Behind the pavilion.
Behind the pavilion. Right. So at the end of the day, you're clattered in mud and blood and snotters.
The girls down in England were the same, Manchester Corinthians. They had stories of getting washed in a duck pond. All because we're banned from playing football, the game that we loved.
Karen Grunwall is a research postgraduate at the University of Stirling, currently doing a PhD on the history of Scottish women's football from 1960 to the present day.
What do you think the predominant driver was in 1921 when the SFA said no women players?
They obviously went with the medical argument that football was too strenuous for women, but if you look at any picture of women working in the First World War, that can get debunked immediately. Professor Jean Williams, who's an authority on the English game, believes it was more to do with money, because what happened was it had been expected that after the First World War, popularity of the women's game would decline, but actually it was about 50-50. So the SFA were thinking, well, this is starting to be a moneymaker, a business, and if the crowds are splitting the gate between the men and the women's match, it's not going to be very cost effective for us. So why no? Let's ban the women's match.
The ban meant the women weren't allowed to use the football pitches, they weren't allowed to use referees or linesmen or whatever. Anything to do with the relevant associations wasn't open for us.
You were just cut off, basically.
We were cut off.
Thrown out of the church, basically.
I denied the chance to play football. And that ban stood in Scotland until 1974.
Which was later than other countries.
It was 1971. The other countries all came into line with the men's game. Out of the 33 European countries, the only country that didn't was Scotland.
Why do you think that was?
Because of the Scottish men. And women, don't get me wrong. In the early 60s, mothers didn't want their lasses kicking a ball. Daddies.
1921, one of the arguments for banning women from football was it would damage your reproductive health.
That brings in Willie Allen of the SFA. In 1972, there were five clubs in Scotland playing on a regular basis, and we got together in Edinburgh and formed the Scottish Women's Association. We were way behind England in this aspect. And the one thing I was adamant I should pursue was to try and get the SFA on board proper. And with that would come proper coaching for the wee kids coming through. We would have disciplinary committees. We would have a proper structure. And Willie Allen, the only thing he could say was, but look, Elsie, what about this? And he was patting to his chest. How can a woman...
Well, so he thought breasts were going to get in the way of your game of football.
Sometimes it did. the better endowed girls. No, it didn't. It certainly didn't. But he was old school, Willie.
In 1974, when they said, OK, fair enough, you know, because of equal rights legislation and because everybody else has adopted it, we're going to adopt it too. Did all of a sudden you discover you had the wholehearted support?
Nope. I don't think that came until maybe 15 years ago.
Friends for over half a century. Elsie and Rose are each other's biggest fans, although you wouldn't think it sometimes.
She has huge amounts of respect for your talents and ability. It just shines out of her when she speaks about it.
That's because she's none. Sorry, Elsie. No, Elsie is the Ronaldo Maradona, the Pele of the organisation of women's football. If it wasn't for Elsie, there wouldn't have been any women's football at a certain level in Scotland, and I think she should be getting recognised for that. It was Elsie that started the whole movement.
In the 60s, we were playing the same teams over and over again, and we were looking for stiffer competition. I heard of this team, Manchester Corinthians, so we went down there. We didn't have a full team that time. Anyway, we get beat 10-1, and I can hear the English fans to this day shouting, "Give us another one." It was pathetic. We were pathetic that day. Anyway, so when I got back home to Stirton, I got in touch with Kilmarnock Football Club and get two of the professional players, Rab Stewart and Billy Neal, talked them into coming along, and I organised trials for the five teams that were playing in Scotland at the time. And from these five teams, final 11 was chosen to play against Manchester Corinthians. So it was actually an unofficial Scotland team.
What was it like actually trying to get the equipment together, get organised?
Well, we didn't have any equipment. Rosie's dad was a provident man, so we got a provi check for Mr. Riley, and we bought a set of Scotland strips with the provi check. Out my own pocket, I bought the Scotland badges. I sewed the Scotland badges on by hand, all excited, because this was the first ever Scotland game against England. We had to look good. My mother, she worked in the knitwear factory, so she took the strips and we got a set of numbers, and the lasses in the factory stitched the numbers onto the back, so that was us. We were professionals, inverted commas. But we had no shorts, so we borrowed shorts for Rangers. And I hate Rangers.
Still burns when I think about it.
Oh, my God. And that was how we get the strips together, because we didn't have any financial backing at all. wee Mary Carr scored a cracking goal, followed by Rose, goal straight for the corner. 2-0, and we get beat 3-2.
The very first captain of the Scotland women's football team was Margaret McAuley-Ray. Margaret joined us at Hampden to look through some of the press coverage of the team from that first international match.
The one in colour there is the full squad for the first game in 1972 against England, and that's all the paper cuttings and reports.
Which is a fair range of stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's the team for the game.
Every single one of them in their own right was a brilliant player.
And yet, the headline in this is all lined up for the glamour match of the year.
That's typical of the press. Yeah.
The poster across there, the Daily Record poster, says the Women's Football Association presents first ever ladies international football match, admission 20p. 20p.
That's all we were worth.
They raised it. That's why the sticker's on top of it. It was less than that.
5p.
It does look like 5p underneath it.
It was 5p.
Remember, Mark, the English team were far, far better organised.
They got the experience that we didn't have at the time.
And guess who they had at midfield? Paddy McGroart, that played for Cambus Land.
That's right, aye.
She got sent to a convent when she... Paddy McGroarty.
You've got to finish that sentence.
Paddy McGroarty was brought up in strong Catholic faith, and her parents sent her to Ireland to a convent to try and get the football out of her system. And I would write to her every week and tell her how well Celtic were doing, hoping to encourage her to come back to the women's game, because she was amazing. She was a great wee player. Yeah. Right. The rest were from Cambus Lang Hoover Factory. Right. They were the team until we came along, but we always managed to beat them.
Yeah, because the Hooverettes sucked.
All together now. We're sitting in the museum at Hampden, you know, the National Stadium in Scotland. There's footballing memorabilia here going back 150 years. Had they been given the opportunity, had there been the backup, had there not been the prejudice, how many female faces would be on these walls?
I can't really answer that, because it was just a thing to do with the men, not accepting that the women could play. And you couldn't hurry that up, because you're changing a whole generation of men. Not just one generation, two generations of men. It's just a Scottish thing, isn't it? Do you think so? You're a man.
A man with a wife and two daughters, I'd be too feared to do it.
But I was the secretary of the association when it first set up, and one of my highlights of my life was my husband said to me one Saturday morning, "Where are you going?" I says, "I'm just going up to Edinburgh, the Football Association meeting." He says, "Aye." He says, "Well, just I'm warning you, just get them to tell you're resigning." I says, "I've made my mind up. I definitely am. I'm going to resign." I really meant it. And I goes through to Edinburgh, put my resignation in, get handed an award for my services to the women's game as a secretary. And the next point in the agenda was they were appointing a Scotland manager. And before they even got to the point in the agenda, some of the Scotland girls up the back that I knew because I'd organised the first game at Greenock, they were shouting, "You don't need to go through the rigmarole, just appoint Elsie, we want Elsie as our manager." And that was it, done and dusted in a matter of seconds. So I had to go back home. Are you laughing?
It was a long journey.
Funny. I really loved him. I had to go back home and tiptoe in, and he was waiting for me. "Well, did you do it?" I says, "Aye, of course, I told you I would. I resigned." "Aye, right, okay." And he turned his back at me. I says, "But I've been appointed the Scotland manager." He never said a word. He just walked out the kitchen, never said a word. And then my first game, wait to tell you this, first game for the Scotland lasses on an SFA pitch was at Parkhead, Celtic Park. Now, I got a phone call at my mother's, and it was Jock Steen on the phone, it wasn't some secretary or whatever, asking if I would bring the Scotland team to play a 20 minutes match before the Greek team Olympiakos were playing in the Champions League or the European Cup in these days. And oh my God, you had to pick me off the stairs. I was sitting in the boat and staring at my mum's, and I'm going, "Oh my God, Mum," I couldn't move. Anyway, away we went and we played this game at Parkhead. The girls played superbly that night, and I was so proud of them. And see, as they come off the pitch, Jock Steen, who had a European tie coming up in half an hour, Jock Steen stood at the tunnel and he shook every girl by hand, patted them in the shoulder, thanked them very much for coming and taking part, and what a pleasure it was to watch such a good game. It was amazing. He didn't need to do that. But that gave us the feeling that it's all right to be a lassie and kick a ball.
I think I'm correct in saying you are the only Scottish player to have played in a World Cup winning side. What was that like?
When I won it and when they said I was the best female footballer in the world, I just thought to myself, that's not bad for a wee lass if it's shooting. That just summed it up. It's just like scoring the goals. The blood goes to your head. You're not thinking right. It's just sheer joy. You're walking Clyde 9. Everybody's wonderful that you see, even though they're not. And you're in the high for a long time after it. When I was winning everything in Italy, I'd won 8 Italian Serie A titles, the Golden Boot or whatever. And when I come home and get inducted, the first female in the Hall of Fame, all my medals and one trophy were in there.
You got awarded a doctorate as well.
My mother would have been really proud of that, and my dad, because, of course, I got expelled from school, by the way, for playing football. So it was very emotional because this was from intellectuals, but they embraced me as if I was the diva of the moment and not them.
When did you give up professional football? Why did you give up? How old were you?
I was 40, but I was still in good nick physically. But when you see that the referees are like wee boys and your teammates, you could be their mother, I thought, better get out of here, pal. I isolated myself for a full year away from my friends and everything, not to get rid of the football, but to analyse where my life was going after football. I had to get it a wee bit out of my system because I was still going for my Fitbit bag in the morning, still polishing my football boots, where there was no reason for it anymore.
The scouts were left stunning, defenders the same, when the seventh flew in the under-8s game. Ha, gie's a bell when yon Ross laddie grows. Yon scouts are still waiting, cause yon laddie was Rose. They tried to disguise you with a shot back in sides, but your smarts were the stone out that nae man could hide. Nae dummy was spat when they gied you a doll. You just went down the playground and swapped for a ball. Rose Riley, the tanner Bob Pelly. They gied you the belt and they prayed to expel you. The Heedies were honing down ban after ban, but Rose Riley was off to Milan. It's easy to quote the movie Your Dreams when you start off in Stirling and you wind up in Reims. Lionesses new rampant were just waking up. Rose Riley had won the World Cup. The net couldn't hold you. You could shoot through a wall. Rose Riley, the belle of the ball. And I've got tears in my eyes.
I can tell. That poem about Rose Riley is called By Ony Other Name and was written by Thomas Clark.
The overall ethos of football in Scotland, I would say, is still pretty aggressive. Does that need to change for women to feel more welcomed in the sport?
It's the way you teach your sons when they're growing up, respect for women. It doesn't matter where you are, a football match or anywhere else. Obviously, it's going to take time with football because it was always going to be a male thing in Scotland. Like my brother, he had a wee boy. Oh, I hope he's going to play for Scotland one day. Then a wee girl was born. You're not going to say that, are you? No, but you should be able to say, I hope she's going to play for Scotland one day. That's what going to the World Cup is going to mean. And I think that will change everything. Even if I'm 100-year-old, crawl on my knees and say, there's a footballer, which I'm very proud of, obviously. So I'm here today to empower women.
I want every wee girl to be encouraged to play this fantastic game because there's no game like it.
Coming into this, I knew absolutely nothing about women's football in Scotland. But what's really impressed me, talking to Rose, Elsie and Margaret, is that with zero support, backing or encouragement, they carried on playing the game that they clearly loved, even when it didn't love them back. It was a genuine pleasure and privilege to meet them. And there we round off this edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast. Thank you very much for downloading us. We will be back in a few days' time with another edition, probably a bit closer to what you're accustomed to, from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen. Thanks for listening.